Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Beth Nielsen Chapman is an American singer-songwriter whose diverse body of work spans 15 albums and 7 number one hits, including compositions that have been recorded by Elton John, Bonnie Raitt, Bette Midler, Willie Nelson, Martina McBride, Neil Diamond, The Indigo Girls, and others. Her music has also been featured in movies and television. This Kiss, ASCAP's 1999 Song of the Year, sung by Faith Hill, garnered her a Grammy nomination. Also nominated for a Grammy in 2012 for The Mighty Sky, Beth was Nashville's NAMMY's 1999 Song of the Year and inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2016. Having lost her husband to cancer in 1994 and her second husband to cancer in 2022, Beth survived breast cancer herself in 2000 and a brain tumor in 2009. Beth's concerts, workshops, and keynotes draw from her direct experience as she shares about the fascinating dance between cognition, healing, and the creative flow. Her songs take you on a journey through the depth, humor, and the wonder of life. Beth's latest album, produced by Ray Kennedy, is called Crazy Town and was released in September of 2022. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Beth Nielsen Chapman. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I'm in my very messy studio in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm doing great. Just got back from a week of writing in Lubbock, Texas, with songwriters from all over the place and a bunch of local songwriters, and it was amazing. And we were doing something for the Buddy Holly. There's a huge book coming out on Buddy Holly, giant volume, and I'm one of the artists featured in it. I'm super honored to be. I'm an ambassador for Buddy Holly Foundation. So, you know, he was the quintessential songwriter for so many generations now, you know.
Exactly. It's pretty amazing. That's interesting. Okay, yeah. So now let's rewind. I know it's a multi number of years journey in the music world. So at what age did you find out or feel, cool, I want to be in this creative space, creative music? And how did that journey progress to where we are today?
You know, I thought I was going to be a veterinarian, and I just ended up picking up the guitar around the age of 11 because my dad got one for Father's Day, but it stayed in my room. in the closet until I presented him with it on Father's Day, which I showed it to him and said, this will be in my room. You can play it anytime you like. And I remember we were living in Germany at the time, because my dad's in the Air Force. So I couldn't find any books in English. And I was, just like putting my fingers down and figuring out the chords and naming them all these weird names because I didn't know what they were called. It took me a couple of years to catch up, but I've always played by ear. And you know, when I got to be a teenager and, you know, started singing at weddings and I'd sing at church and it just kind of evolved. And I just wrote songs and poems all the time and ended up getting my first deal when I was 15 and my dad had to co-sign it. And it was a terrible contract. And then I got out of that one and, you know, it's just been a thing that just keeps evolving and unfolding, you know, and there's been times when I think, okay, now I made it. It's great. It's all perfect. It's all going to be great from now on. And then it'll just like be a brick wall, you know, and then I'll have to wait another 5 years. So, but I've decided that's part of the process of becoming a better songwriter because life brings you stuff. And, you know, if you don't have stuff, there's usually not as much to write about. So I'm not complaining. I'm still kicking.
So when you have those situations or circumstances where that brick wall comes, what is the motivation for you to say, okay, yes, you understand they're there to help your creative process, but what is the thing like, okay, it's another brick wall. I know it's here for whatever reason it is. Does it ever deter you think, oh, to another one?
I've probably felt that way. You know, we moved to Nashville in 85 and it took about 3 or 4 years to get some things going. And I started having some success. I wrote a big hit for Tanya Tucker and then a Willie Nelson and my phone started ringing and then, you know, started getting more and more. And then my husband got very ill and he was really just given a very short period of time to live. And he ended up living about three times as long, like about 18 months. But he did pass away, and my son was turning 12. And that was one of the big ones where I was just like, maybe I can't do this. And during that time, and even before that time, I was writing, kind of writing into that. And I tend to write my songs sometimes. I'm working on a song, and I don't even realize that the song is about something that hasn't even happened yet. It's happened to me several times. And with my first husband, Ernest, it was like this whole group of songs came together. And about a year after he passed, I made this album called Sand and Water, which was really just about the whole journey of going through that. And, you know, so rather than stopping me from writing it, it kind of propelled it in a way. It's one of those things where I just think writing has sort of saved me through the whole process. Mm-hmm. And 6 years later, I went through breast cancer. So there was that, you know, that was like a brick wall. I was supposed to put this record out. And the last day of mixing the record, I found out I had stage 2 breast cancer, and I had to go through a year of treatment. And everything on that album that I had already written really sounded like I was writing an album about going through what I was getting ready to go through. So it's kind of wildly wondrous to me how creativity and songs come through, start to get written even before those events in life happen. So
yeah.
I say brick wall, but they're really more like portals. Like, now we're over here, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I was telling somebody this the other day. I said, you know, having to go through chemo and all my hair coming out and everything, I said, you know, once you've had that happen, you can never have a bad hair day. Because if you have any hair at all, it's going to be fine, you know? So perspective is everything.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I have had a lot of stuff happen to me, but I have been so grateful that music has been the one way that I heal through it.
Thank you for sharing all those beautiful parts or experiences. But now, from 0 from 3 to 4 minutes in creating a song, I know you already said that it's from the experiences, from the brick walls, from those things that are happening, or pre-thoughts coming through.
Yeah.
Is it easy every time? What motivates it? What invigorates it? We already understand it's from those experiences. But what is your creative brain and creative process in creating something?
Sometimes it's spontaneous and it just comes through me, and then I figure out what it is later. And sometimes it's something that I have a vision for, like I want to do a project and I see it, you know, and then it takes way longer to get it finished than I thought it would, usually, because that's life, you know. And I did a project in 2007, for instance, that really took me 10 years from when I started it to when I finished it. And, you know, part of the thing that happened, I wanted to do a project where, and this is like got nothing to do with having hits on country radio, which was sustaining me and paying the light bills. I wanted to do a record in all different languages from different paths of faith. And I realized when I got into it, it's like, there's so many different paths, you know, it's like, this is going to take forever. And I thought, but I wanted my voice to be kind of like a common thread. And ironically, right about that time, one of my dear friends, who was a book agent, she represented Bishop Tutu. And
okay.
Ended up, you know, telling him about it. And I had met him when, like a year after 9/11. So it would have been 2002, right.
Yeah.
Right. And, he was speaking at the Washington National Cathedral, and I was invited to sing, and it was amazing. His talk was about, you know, how all these different cultures should help each other, lift each other up and not squash each other so much. And beautifully done. And I ended up sitting next to him after that at a brunch. And my friend was on the other side of him, and she said, Beth, why don't you tell the Arch about your project that you're doing, in all different languages from all different paths of faith? And I'm like, I haven't really had a chance to finish it. It's laying up. And he was so sweet. He said, oh, you have to do it, you know, and he said, just say yes and God will handle all the details. And so I said, yes. And then amazingly, things started unfolding over the next, it took another 6 years. But I ended up coming to South Africa and working with Joseph Arthur and Victor Masando, producing with me. And
okay.
I did strings in Johannesburg and Cape Town. I think we did some stuff in Cape Town. Anyway, I fell in love with South Africa, but that project was one of those ones where I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. And then I thought, no, I'm not. It's too complicated. And then I just let go. And, you know, since Archbishop Desmond Tutu said all I had to do was say yes, I said, okay, yes. And I let it unfold. And I did that record while doing 3 other records before I finished it, you know. So the way that my work to answer your question in a very long-winded way, the way that my work comes through me is sort of ADHD, which is what I am. I have a lot of television sets on in my head at the same time, and I just have to go, I'm going that way, you know. So it's all kind of chaotic in a way, but it's also in divine order. I can trust that it's in divine order, even when I'm like, I don't know what's happening now.
You know? You reference televisions in your brain. So I'm not sure if you're aware of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. So that's the way people process information. So part of that, there are three elements that people process information on. And we each have a dominant one, a secondary one, and a tertiary one. So what that means is we'll be in it for most of the day, the dominant one. Secondary one will be in it for a couple of hours. Tertiary will be in it for about half an hour, if at all. Now, there are three of them. So there's visual. So that means people create pictures with the information they're receiving. So you hear a story and you're creating pictures in your brain with that story. Then you've got then you've got auditory people. They hear the words. They understand the word, put the word into the sentence, understand the sentence, then understand the paragraph and so forth. So it's all about the words and the verbal or audio communication. Then you've got kinesthetic. So kinesthetic, that word again, kinesthetic is people process information through the unseen things, which is basically body language, tone of voice, energy, emotions, all those different elements. Now, focusing specifically on music now, because it will overlap, you'll have each will play out sort of in everyday lives in different ways. But focusing specifically on music, when you're listening to music by other artists or on your own or of your own songs, are you creating pictures in your mind of the songs you're hearing? Is it about the words and lyrics, or is it about the feeling and emotion?
That's such a great question. And what's that called again? Linguistic what?
Neuro-linguistic programming.
Neuro-linguistic programming.
NLP.
I'm going to read more about that.
Yeah, NLP.
That's fascinating. I haven't actually heard of that, but I'm sure I've been drowning in it my whole life, because you're talking about is, you know, the ways, and this is what I, you know, I teach a lot of workshops and I teach a lot of classes and go and teach a lot about songwriting. And I'm always trying to get the students to get into a place where they can be comfortable not knowing what they're doing. Because if you know what you're doing, then you're repeating something that's known. If you're actually creating something from that's a new thing, then it's coming through with all of those things you mentioned. Mm-hmm. All those avenues are available. And you're right. Some people tend to go hear it more this way or that way. For me, it's this kind of space between my brain and my intellect and what I know is where I'm at, you know, like what I know I want to say or where, you know, where I think it goes, like it's like a cliff. And then there's like over the side of the cliff is creative flow. And I've learned to trust that it's a collaboration with that. It's a collaboration with collective wisdom of energetic everything, of all thought and all manifestations of, it's very woo woo, you know.
Yeah.
You know, one of the little exercises that I do to get people to play with this idea is to, I'll tell them they have to close two sets of eyelids. You have your outside eyelids, and then inside there you have another set of eyelids. So I want you to close your outside eyelids and open your inside eyelids. And then I'll tell them to like reach down your shirt, pull that thing out, and then go 1, 2, 3. And with just your inside eyelids, open up your hand and what's in the palm of your hand. And they go, what? You know, I'll say, whatever comes into your mind, whatever, it doesn't matter what it is. And that little leap into, well, what's it going to be? And then something, your brain comes up with something, or maybe it's not your brain.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
It's not.
Yeah.
So there's this realm of mysterious kind of collaboration with all of these ways to perceive. One is hearing. One is, like you said, the pictures. Like sometimes I'll get a song started and I'll start to see a movie in my head and I'm watching the movie and it's creating itself. I'm not saying, and now I'm going to have this person do that. It's more oh, now the person's doing that. It's sort of like when writers talk about writing a novel and then they say the character is really driving me crazy. You know, like it becomes this thing outside yourself that's trying to tell you what it wants to be when it grows up. And that's what I say to my students. I say, pay attention to what the song is trying to tell you it wants to be, because the song is way smarter than we are. I just follow the song. And a lot of times I'll start a melody and then I'll just be going, you know, just like nonsense syllables.
Yeah.
And if I go back, like if I finish that song 2 months later, if I go back to that first work tape, that first moment that I recorded the idea before I even had anything, the vowels will most of the time line up perfectly with the first verse. So it's already there. The song is already there, and we're just downloading it in layers if we are willing to take, you know, to trust that. I think it works. I mean, I think it's a real thing. You can't convince somebody because I have no proof, but
I can attest, because I've now spoken to over 250 artists from around the world. And what they've said, all of them, 90% have said to me is the exact same thing to you in different words, that they're just the vessel for this creativeness to come through, and they're just tapping into the ether for that information. Exactly.
Yeah. It's a thing. It's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love, you know, my favorite thing is when I'm working with groups and workshops, sometimes people come to my workshops, they might be in their 60s and they've never written a song. They've never done any, they don't think they're creative. They don't think they have permission to be creative. And the first thing I tell them is, there's no such thing as being creative. It's not that you are creative.
Yeah.
It's that you are in creativity. It's like saying, you know, I'm oxygen. No, I'm breathing oxygen. It's actually keeping me alive, but yeah. I'm not oxygen, you know?
Yes.
So creativity is like oxygen to me. It's like we use it, and some people have a better system for being more efficient with it. And they can really, like Paul Simon's really got some good lungs on him as a songwriter, you know? And because he's like a power swimmer of a songwriter. So you can develop and improve your capacity to have this experience just by showing up, which, you know, the show up muscle is the most important one.
Exactly.
Showing up and having fun and playing too, taking all the pressure off. I have, you know, so many times when I've had a song that was a hit, my phone starts ringing and people like, hey, write me one of those. Write me that song, you know, for my artist. I'm like, I kind of already did that, but
yeah.
You know, I try, but it's, if I ever try to write a hit or try to repeat something I've kind of done, it falls flat. Creativity does not go backwards. It only goes, you know, into the next thing.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that. So what's coming up? I know you've been on tour and traveling. So what's coming up for the rest of this year or next year? What's the plans?
Well, this coming Friday, I'm having my hand operated on.
Oh, wow.
So that's not going to be fun. Yes, I have. I fell and I fractured my wrist, and then I have a tendon that got messed up, and then I have a couple of other things going on in my hand. It's very routine, but of course I'm terrified and I'm like, you know. So I just went on this writing trip. I'm not allowed to play guitar. Most of the time I have a brace on it, but until after this operation. Mm. So I took this tiny little ukulele and I was just, you know, like barely touching it. And all of a sudden now I can play ukulele. So I've been kind of just feeling like I'm going to get on the other side of that. In terms of the rest of the year, I'm going to just kind of write, and I'm going to have to take like 8 weeks off and do a bunch of physical therapy and stuff, but it should be fine. And then, you know, in the new year, I've got some things coming together. I really need to get back in the studio. I've got so many songs piling up. I've just been so busy running around. So once I get my hand back, I'll probably get back in the studio early in the year and start recording again.
So when you go in to write a song, because we know that you've written songs for others and you write your songs for yourself. So when you're hopping into that studio, and we know creativity is fluid and we're tapping in, do you know at a point, okay, this is a song I'm writing for myself, or this is a song that I'm going to be writing for another artist? How does that work?
I always follow the song, and I never think of a song as, you know, either or. I feel like, one of my biggest songs, the songs that are probably my biggest hit, that I've had the most success on is a song called This Kiss, which was a big hit for Faith Hill.
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
And I wrote that with, Robin Lerner and Annie Roboff, and even just three way, you know, being a third writer on it, it still put my son through college. So it was a really successful song. So when I finished the song, you know, and I was playing it out and people were like, oh my God, that's a smash, you know, like it still took a year to get cut, believe it or not. And it was pitched around, and I mean, a lot of people passed on it, and I was like, wow, it's such a catchy song. It's sort of weird. Anyway, so then Faith cut it, and I sang all the background vocals on her record, and then it was a huge hit. And people, you know, when I play it in my show, which I do, and I've actually recorded my own version of it, people say, wow, do you regret giving that to Faith Hill? And I say, no, I do not. Because Faith Hill was like, early 30s, just, you know, she was a star rising. She'd had two or three big hits, and this was her next level hit. if I had put it out, it might have gotten some great airplay. It might have even been a hit, but it wouldn't have been a major international smash because I didn't have that momentum going as an artist.
Yeah.
So I always hold out that I can cut it anyway. In terms of who it's written for, I literally write it for the song. You know, if I'm writing a song with another person for an artist, if it starts to become a really great song, but it's not really looking like it's going to be for the artist, I'm like, but let's finish this song like this way, because the song wants to be this way, to be the best it can be. So I kind of detach a little bit, or I hold it lightly, who it's for. Now, that said, after my first big hit, which was called Strong Enough to Bend, that Tanya Tucker recorded that I wrote with Don Schlitz, my phone was ringing, and one of the calls was from Fred Foster, who was a legendary producer in Nashville. He signed Dolly Parton and Kris Kristofferson all, you know, when they were very young, and he ran Monument Records, and he was producing Willie Nelson, who was my hero, and I knew every Willie Nelson song. He was he's one of the great writers of all time, but for some reason he had so much going on, he hadn't had time to write, and they had to turn in an album. And so, Fred was pestering Willie. We need you to turn, you know, we need to get in the studio. And Willie said, well, I don't have anything. Why don't you call up whoever wrote that Strong Enough to Bend song? Get them to write me something. And he did. He called me up and I'm like, ah. So, you know, I wrote him 5 songs, actually, that he ultimately recorded. But this one called Nothing I Can Do About It Now, the whole time I was writing it, I was thinking, Willie Nelson, you know, on the road again. You know, I kind of got that little rhythm. And, you know, I kind of tried to become Willie Nelson. So that was an example of really trying to write for an artist, because I sure did want him to cut it. And I was so thrilled when he did, you know. So it works all different ways. But when an assignment like that comes through, I really kind of, you know, put on my big girl pants and did it.
When a situation like that happens where your hero that you've known all their songs for, and all of a sudden you're writing a song for them, is it a situation of, is this really happening? A bit of imposter syndrome, or it's like, it's just the next level of the footprints and imprints and roots I've been planting?
Yeah, it's imposter syndrome just goes with it. You know,
okay.
You know, I got invited to go and play on the record when Willie cut that song, and I'm looking around. I know all the guys in his band just from being such a huge fan, you know, pinching myself. And I mean, to this day, that was in 1990. You can imagine that's a lot of years later. I'm still like, I get up and go, did that really happen? Oh my God. You know, and it's amazing.
I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. I love the aesthetic of the holding of something, the journey of the choice, the receiving, the unpacking, the booklet, listening from song one to whatever number. I'm not unsure if you're aware, CDs, even cassettes, vinyls, massive comebacks. Vinyls in the UK last year alone, 5.9 million sales, the biggest since 1990. In the UK as well, a basket of goods that they gauge taxes for. Vinyls have been in that basket for a while, and because of the upsurge of CDs now, CDs are now back in that basket. And the research is showing that it's not the older nostalgic people diving or repurchasing stuff. It's the teenagers and the early 20s who are diving into the physical world. But then we also have these streaming platforms that people consume music on. What are your perceptions of the landscape at the moment?
Well, I'll try to not get to be, answer you in 3 hours because it's so complicated.
Yes, but
I will say this, and this is one of the things I think is very important for songwriters, young up and coming songwriters, to know that copyrights, I'm talking about the song, not the artist and the recording. There's these three things that make the pie, and the pie is the person singing it, the artist, the person who composed it, the songwriter, which might be the same person as the artist, and the person who records it. So the sort of the producer and the record company. So those are, to me, those are three pieces of the pie that should be equally divided. Right now, it's so wrong the way it's divided in streaming. It's based on antique mathematical figurings. And the reason it is that way is just because they could get away with it. And, you know, there's just a lot that's not acceptable about the income streams for the composers. If you literally took the song out of the equation, the whole music business would collapse.
Exactly.
So, you know, it should be treated like a partner more. And that's what I aspire to. But in the meantime, before we get to where we have something more close to that, And I think it's very important to engage and try to be a part of the solution for that. I also think that writers and creators need to be very careful to separate out the energy they use to combat that and to speak up for that, which is important, and their writing. The writing and the body of work that you make as a creator is sacred. And whether you ever sell a song or hear a song on the radio that you wrote, it's most important that you do your body of work. So if you find getting tangled up in the, oh, it's not fair, and if that depletes your energy as a writer, then step back from that because other people are working on it. It's not fair. It's not right. But if you have a song that is a hit song and it's streaming millions of times and you're getting a check for $1,400, which is ridiculous, know that your composition has made a lot more than that. It's just that the plumbing is such that somebody took the water from the pipe and routed it over here.
Yeah.
And I told somebody the other day, it's like the music business moved into a new building and they put the songwriters in the basement with the old plumbing from the other building.
Yes.
And they didn't change the plumbing.
Yeah.
And we're getting drip, drip, drip. But the actual deluge that's coming in, and I'm saying, you know, people go, well, you can't make any money streaming because it doesn't generate any money. It generates tons of money. Look at how big the buildings are that Spotify's building, you know. So you can get me on a whole roll on this, but most importantly, I think it's to maintain your integrity and your understanding of the value of songs. And you know, ask any human, what's your favorite song? What's a song that saved your life? What's a song that made you fall in love with someone? You know, songs are so important to our lives. And it's not just, oh, I love the way that person sang. It's the song. It's what they're singing. It's
exactly.
It's the content of what they're singing. That's just as important as how beautifully they sang it and how nice it was recorded. So that's my short version.
No, but it's a very fascinating, interesting. And what's also interesting, a lot of the fans who don't really necessarily dive into the world of it and are just sort of peripheral observers and like this track or that track or maybe this album or this artist and maybe go to one or two concerts here and there. They don't know that how it's going or what the thing is. And they see artists saying, oh, I had 100 million streams. I think, oh, this artist is making so much money. They don't realize it's only $1,000. So there's that knowledge that needs to be shared in a positive way, as you say. Correct.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, it's not all a positive thing, but I think it's important to resurrect your creative soul and keep it out of the fray of all that. You know, I mean, I always say there were two lives of an artist. One was Picasso and one was Van Gogh. Picasso was celebrated and asked to dinner and, you know, he was woo. And Van Gogh never sold a painting except to his brother, you know, one painting his whole life. I mean, and if he had given up, then we wouldn't have this incredible treasure of his work. So I just say to my students, like, imagine you're filling a cave wall with your experience of life and it's full of songs. So if somebody stumbles into the cave 2,000 years after you died, what are you going to tell them? What do you have to say about it all? That is so valuable. And it's valuable to your children and your grandchildren, and it's valuable to your health and your mental health, I think, to express yourself. Oh, and the music business is very much a whole big giant octopus thing that you have to wrestle with.
Yeah.
But I've tried, you know, a couple of times when it's knocked me back, I've gone and licked my wounds and then gone back to writing. I write because I'm going to write anyway. Try to remember. And remember, those suckers are making a lot of money off of us. Someday they're going to have to pay us back.
Exactly.
So I'm a little mad about it too.
Yeah. Okay. So I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 10 years, 5 hours, I know your answer will be different every time simply because there are millions of them. I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists, once we finish this conversation, your face, what would be those songs and by whom? Like I said, top of mind, no reasoning, just like this came.
Okay. As long as I don't have to be held feet to the fire when I remember 12 other ones later and go,
no,
oh,
no.
I should have said that one.
No, not at all. Because I know later I'll ask you and you'll give me another 5. So I understand that.
Right. Okay. Penny Lane, Beatles. I love Suzanne Vega's My Name is Luca.
Yes.
You may be too young to know that one. Joni Mitchell, Wow, there's so many that are my favorites. What's it called? Well, Help Me. That's a great one. I mean, they're all great. And So It Goes. I think it's Billy Joel. And So It Goes.
Okay.
Fragile. Sting.
One more.
How fragile we are. Oh, I'm all out of choices. A song that you may not know that was written by Firmino. Look it up. It's one of the greatest songs ever written. It's kind of obscure. It's called Broken Man's Lament. Mark Germino. He just passed away not too long ago.
Okay.
Mark Germino.
Germino. Okay.
Yeah.
Lovely. Nice mix.
Yeah.
Some of them on my list. I need to add the rest. So thank you for those bits of musical nuggets. So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
Walk outside and look at the sun first thing every morning and try to get in touch with what's good. Because there's a whole bunch of other crap that's flying around. That's the best armor you have, is grateful, being grateful.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.